This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh, wow, I'm having such a wonderful time. It's 2020, and I'm having one fantastic guest after another. And today I am so happy to welcome back to Joy on Paper, Nick Petrie, because I just love his books, and the new book is called The Wild One. And Nick, hi, it is amazing.
Well, hi, Patsy. Thanks so much for having me back, and it's great to talk to you.
Well, it's so nice. You know, my son came up to see you at, he's in Madison, and he came to one of your book signings and brought you a t-shirt from me, because, you know, I am such a great admirer of your work. And now the new book, I tell you, this new book is amazing.
Oh, thank you so much. It was both fun to write and a serious challenge to write.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, now this is the fifth book in the series, right?
Yes, ma'am.
And you know, they're all great. And we'll talk a little bit about, you know, just this wonderful character you've developed, Peter Ash, who has, you know, suffering from PTSD. And if, for people who haven't read the books, you can give a little background. But I just want to say, first of all, it's such a fresh book because I love the location that you selected. You know, after a while, you know, when people have series, they tend to be more or less in the same type of locale, the same, you know, place, and you sort of expect a certain thing. So when this came as a complete surprise to me, I didn't know what the setting was. And so I love that. And then I want to tell you, I have to compliment you on the first four pages of this book.
Why, thank you.
You know, authors work very hard to get, you know, readers to be interested in a book. But when you can do what you did in the first four pages, you manage to create characters that are so believable and so interesting, and a character that we really care about, that we really, that will carry us throughout the book because we really care. And you do it, it's almost magical. I read the first four pages, you know, once I read that, and then I continue to the next chapter, and the next chapter, of course, is about Peter Ash, and we have a fun little thing where somebody with PTSD is stuck in an airplane, and I felt very sympathetic for him. But I went back, I read the second chapter, and then I took a deep breath. I said, wow, Nick has done something so amazing with the first four pages that I know now that I read them, I will never forget them. And I just have to compliment you on this, because this is a real talent to be able to do in four pages what you did here.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you to say. It's interesting. One of the interesting things about this series, and I think why it has sort of caught so much attention and picked up so much momentum so quickly is the characters. And I think people, you know, sometimes people say, well, this is a character about a Marine Corps veteran with post-traumatic stress. It's going to be sort of a guy book. But I think it's, I have so many female readers. I actually have more female readers than male readers, because although these books are very fast-paced and there's a lot going on, I think it really is the characters that sort of feeling the emotional connections to the characters that really kind of sucks people in the way it obviously did for you. So that's a huge compliment for me.
Well, it's really the premise is so simple. You introduce a family, but you introduce them in such with I was, you know, I reread it a couple of times. I said, how did he manage? And he mentioned this, he mentioned that, he mentioned this, that it was like a full-blown family to me. I could see them. I could feel them. And I thought, you know, I don't know. I never know, for example, because I never read the blurbs that come with books. I never look at the promo stuff that they send me. Because
I never read the inside flap. I always want to sort of see it fresh.
Exactly. That's what I need to see it fresh. I need to just immerse myself in the story. And in this case, as I said, it was almost, it's really magical to do it in four pages. And I went back and I analyzed the words. I said, he used just that right word, that how one simple word can create a vision in your mind. And I thought it was just, it's just beautiful.
Well, thank you. You're making me blush, Patsy.
Well, you know, I don't know if how long it took you to write that first four pages, if it was a work that, you know, you worked over and over, if it just came to you, but whichever way it did, it's really perfect.
Well, it's interesting. Part of the, you know, some pieces of the book sort of show up fully formed, and some of the pieces I have to work and rework and rework, and there's a string of sections that are all about this family. And I wrote, I think there are eight sections, and I wrote the first six of them in probably 3 days or 4 days. And I always go back over and over things. The sentences are really important to me. Word choice is really important to me. I work far harder at this than some do, because it's just kind of.
Are you there? Oh boy, Nick.
I can hear you.
Oh, okay. I couldn't hear you there for a minute. Okay, so let's go back to word choices. Okay.
But I'm word choice is really important to me. How the sentences are put together are really important to me, and so it's not just that first flash of what shows up, but I have to rework things over and over to get them kind of just right. And I always put myself then in the reader's seat to sort of what is the effect? How does it feel as a reader? So it's an interesting process.
Well, you did a perfect job with this first four pages, and I'm sure people will use it as an example of how to get listeners or readers really deeply just jumping into the book and not wanting to come out. And of course, then on top of it, we have a wonderful, as I said, you have a new location. It's fresh, and I really enjoy it. So tell us how you got that idea for this new location.
Well, the book is set in Iceland. And a few years ago, my son and I went there for a backpacking trip. We backpacked across the Hornstrandir National Reserve in the northwest corner of Iceland. It's just a stone's throw from the Arctic Circle. And the way you get there, we were dropped off by a boat on this little rocky, isolated shore, and we had to crisscross this snowy mountainous peninsula multiple times to reach our pickup location 5 days later. There are no roads into the reserve, so you take a boat in and out. And it was such a captivating and lonely place. I really fell in love with it and with the hardy Icelandic people we met along the way. And at the end of the trip, waiting to board our plane home, actually, this book just kind of appeared in my head, more or less fully formed, which has never happened to me before. I got about 20 minutes of this vision in my head, and I scribbled madly in my little notebook, hoping to kind of capture everything I could. And then I spent the next couple of years really trying to get that down and build it out into a novel.
Well, I love the way that at the beginning of the book you put a little bit of a pronunciation guide, because for people who, you know,
who don't happen to speak Icelandic.
Yeah, exactly. I thought that was very helpful.
Patsy?
Yeah?
I've lost you. Boy, something's going on.
Are you on your landline? Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, I don't know what's going on.
All right, well, okay. Start with your last question again.
Okay, well, I was saying that I like the pronunciation guide.
Well, most people don't happen to speak Icelandic. There are, you know, only, you know, 300,000 or 400,000 Icelandic speakers in the whole world. But, you know, somebody else, another interviewer asked me the other day, that he said it didn't seem intrusive at all, but he was worried that the names and the place names would be sort of hard to pronounce or hard to think about. And I actually put a lot of care into choosing names that felt different but that were recognizable to the eye.
Yeah.
And that was part of the, you know, part of the challenge about writing about Iceland. Now, the place names I can't really do anything about, and some of them are like, you know, 8 or 9 syllables long, with a lot of consonants in them that don't always come trippingly off the tongue.
Well, what I enjoyed about the book, you created really the landscape for us, because I've read books about Iceland, and it's sort of intrigued me over the years, but really with this book, I really had a better vision. I think you really looked at the country and bring us right there.
Well, place is really important to me, and if you go back to my earlier books, they're all set in a different location. So I have a book that's set in Milwaukee, one on a sort of on the high tech West Coast, another in Denver in the sort of the newly legal cannabis world. Another set in Memphis. So these are all very different locations. But the wonderful thing about changing settings with every book is you really get to have that location becomes a character in itself, and it lends a flavor to the book that I never really understand when I begin kind of how the setting is going to really influence the book. But it does. It influences the choices I make along the way. It influences the characters who show up and how they interact. It's so much fun, and it also really helps me make each book distinct from the next, because I love series fiction, but you can always sort of tell when a writer is starting to lose interest because they sort of blend together. And my pet peeve always is I'm reading a book and I get partway through or halfway through and I say, wait a minute, I've read this before. So my goal is to have these books be so distinctive from each other, yet still be very much sort of an adventure story as Peter Ash would live it. So there are some things that, you know, you want it to have the same flavor, but you want them to be different enough that they all stand out.
And this one particularly does, because as I said, it came as such a, it was so refreshing. I was sort of almost like a sip of ice water, because it's like we're in Iceland, and it's something that I hadn't thought about really a great deal. But after I read the book, I'm thinking, whoa, this is interesting, and you really captured it. And of course, there's so many things inherent in Iceland, problems. You know, for somebody who wants to have some adventure, there's plenty of opportunity there in what Peter goes through with who you know, about the weather and all of this. So you really captured that.
Well, thank you.
Now let's talk a little bit about Peter, because we're coming along with this guy through the five books, and you know, he's got this PTSD. We, as with anybody who knows anybody with PTSD, we always hope that, I don't know if the term is get better, but I'm not sure that they like that term, but it's for them, it's a lifelong process to overcome PTSD. And so when you put Peter in an airplane, well, several airplanes, I thought, well, one airplane wasn't enough. You have to put him in a couple of airplanes.
Well, my goal as a writer is to make life as miserable for my character as possible, right?
Well, you did. You did. I thought, oh, boy.
Well, the thing about post-traumatic stress, I think you really hit the nail right on the head. I mean, some people do get past it. For some, post-traumatic stress lasts for a month or 6 months or a year. But I know people who are still struggling with their post-traumatic stress that comes from the Vietnam War. So it's been 50 years, and they face it every day. And I really don't think it's about, for those people, it's not about getting better. It's learning to kind of make friends with it, learning to kind of accept it, and learning how to work around those challenges. And when I first started this series, I sort of thought, well, Peter will get better. He'll face this demon, and then he'll move on. And it became really clear as I continued to do research that doesn't happen for a whole lot of people. And so I wanted to kind of chart the course that Peter makes from book to book. So sometimes it gets better, and in this book it gets worse. He has a relapse. But what are the things that veterans can do to help with the symptoms, to help kind of work their way through, to become friends with this lifelong issue? And that's part of the fun for me, and it's become kind of the mission for me. You would not believe how many veterans reach out to me telling me that I've told in a way that Peter's story is kind of their story. I had a guy who found me on Facebook who told me actually that he had been suicidal, and he read my first book, The Drifter, and he realized that there wasn't anything wrong with him. His brain had changed, and he had to learn how to work with that. Because really, he sent me a picture of himself and his wife and his three kids, and it was so touching. That's really kind of the best part of what I do, is getting to keep having those conversations. But that's the thing that I think veterans and civilians don't understand about post-traumatic stress, is that there's nothing wrong with you. This is a normal, biophysical process that happens. Your brain rewires itself because of sustained and stressful situations.
And self, so it's really self-preservation. Your brain is trying to keep you from being overcome by everything, but at the same time, it's difficult. I know I've worked a lot with Vietnam vets from F-105 pilots and the ground crews, and I have been on the computer at 3 o'clock in the morning with somebody who was there, and or was in one of the POW in Hanoi Hilton, and I'm typing, and we're type chatting back and forth at 3 o'clock in the morning because he still can't sleep, and that's, as you said, 50 years ago. And I think your series, I know I've heard from people, and as I said, my son came up to your book signing and he got a chance to meet some of the people around who were at the event, and he said the same thing, that the vets, because he's very aware of vets because of my work with vets, they were all saying, well, he wasn't in combat, but he's captured this feeling. He understands us and he cares about us. And I know that you do a lot of work with veterans and different organizations.
Well, I do less than I'd like, to be very honest. The schedule my publisher has me on is pretty heavy duty, but that's really the best compliment for me as a writer that I can get, is to have somebody tell me that I have captured their experience, and it's really our job is to write about, to put ourselves in other people's shoes. It's an act of empathy, really, and that's again kind of both the best part and the real challenge of what writers do.
Well, as I said, that's why I thought with the first chapter it was fantastic. You brought us, and I can see that you could write that family story, sort of just straight off, because you created such an interesting storyline with them, and then I went to BoucherCon a few months ago, and after being on a plane stuffed with people, and I could just see Peter, big guy, and I felt so bad that there he is squished among all those, the humanity of it. I could appreciate what he was going through.
Well, I'm about to head out on book tour in a couple of days as we're having this conversation, and I love the book events. I love talking to readers. I love booksellers and these great independent bookstores. But my least favorite part is the planes, trains, and automobiles, and getting jammed in a little seat and spending 4.5 hours on a flight is my idea of hell, quite frankly. So, that feeling from that first Peter Ash chapter is an exaggerated version of how I feel when I have to squeeze myself onto a plane.
Well, I of course I love the fact that I love the storm sequence and all of the sort of out there in the wilderness part. I enjoy that anyway. I've always loved the wilderness. I've come from northern Michigan, so wilderness was part of my childhood and being outdoors. And so I particularly love this part here in this book.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. One of the challenges. I sort of set myself an assignment for every book, and one of the assignments for this book was to really push Peter to his limits and to have Peter kind of stuck in his own head in a way. And the man against nature story is always sort of a man against self story at the same time, and so those kind of play off each other. And reflect each other, and that's part of the fun of this story. Indeed, was kind of remembering the colossal winter storms of my childhood and how it felt to be, 10 years old and have the snow up to my waist and to sort of transplant Peter into that.
Yeah, I being a youper, I lived through a couple really rough blizzards when we were kids, and so I know that feeling, and that's why I think I enjoyed it so much having Peter in a new environment. And it's you've done a absolutely terrific job with this book, and I, as you said, you're off on tour, and the new book is called The Wild One. I think it's every one of your books is great, but this one somehow particularly because I think of that first chapter, and I cared so much about Oscar, and I cared so much about really the also about Peter. You know, as you said, in some books he seems to get easy. You feel, it's funny how we have this connection with him. Once we get to know him, we really want him to have good things happen to him and happy things happen to him. And so this is the mark of a really great author. Now, I noticed that Publishers Weekly just gave you a big thumbs up, right?
Oh, there was a nice starred review. Oh my God, I can't remember quite the quote, but it really made my month, I think, that review from Publishers
Weekly. Yeah, they said wonderful things. And of course, you happen to have a little blurb on the cover. Just a sort of a common, ordinary blurb every author just sort of dreams about,
Yeah, Lee Child has been very kind to me, and I think has helped drive this series forward as well. I'm a huge fan of his, so it's nice to know he's also a fan of mine.
Well, you deserve it, and I think you've done just such a terrific job with this book. And what's your website so people can go to it?
NickPetrie.com. Pretty simple.
Pretty simple. And again, I want to thank you for really starting my year off. This is going to be a fantastic year. The other day I had Andrew Grant.
Oh yeah, I'm going to see him in Scottsdale in a couple of days. He is a lovely guy.
Oh, he's wonderful, and he lets me call him Drew. And because when he went to a school in England called St. Albans, and so I knew the school very well, so I call him the old Albanian, and he's a wonderful, wonderful guy. And Tasha, they were both on the program, and I know that they love your books too. And so, I want to again thank you for starting my year off. So it's so beautiful. And Nick Petrie, I want to thank you for being on Joy on Paper today.
Oh, thank you so much, Patsy. I appreciate the conversation, and I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye bye now.
Bye, Patsy. Thanks.
Okay, we're going to go to commercial, and then we'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at larsonpatentlaw.com.
How many of you listening today yearn to write stories, poems, or novels? Each of you has a story to tell, or knows of a story that others would love to read if only you could put the words on a page. The many writers' clubs in the Bay Area understand this urge and would welcome any new writer to learn with them. So go ahead and take the first step to becoming a well-known author. Sponsored by the Pinellas Writers Club.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, and this is such an honor to welcome to Joy on Paper Anne Devereaux Mills, the author of The Parlay Effect and Parlay House and just all sorts of wonderful things. Hi, Anne.
Hi, so great to meet you.
Wow, this is an honor. I'm starting off 2020, and I've been wanting to really inspire people this year. I want to make sure that I reach out and talk to people who, one of the things I say on this, when I start my program, is this is a program for writers and those who dream of writing. And I just want so much to encourage people to get out there and do what they want and dream big dreams. And you certainly have done that.
If you had said to me 10 years ago, you'll have written a book, which on the first half of the first day would become an Amazon bestseller, I would have thought you were absolutely crazy, because this is a later in life endeavor that took me in a whole new thrilling direction into the world of writers. And it's so fun to be here, and unexpected and supportive and joyful and positive. So thanks, Patsy, for including me in your work.
Well, I love that you use the word joyful, because this is a word that it means so much to me. Because when I was thinking of doing the program, now you started 10 years ago. I started less than 5 years ago. When I started this program, I had no experience. I had never been on the radio. In fact, I was surprised that you wrote a book, surprised that I'm on the radio, because I was so shy that I would always, be very active in clubs and everything, but I'd always take the position where I wouldn't have to be the talker. And so one day, in the middle of the night, I decided to do a radio show. And literally in the middle of the night at 4:00 in the morning. And a few weeks later, I'm
you
on the radio.
Your voice.
And
it's amazing.
It's amazing. It is amazing, and it's such a thrill. And so now you've experienced it. I've experienced this wonderful joy of finding something that we love.
Yes. Yes, and I think part of it is this constant reinvention in different stages of life. So I've found other things that I've loved before in different contexts, and this is sort of the right thing at this stage. For me, to be learning something new and trying something new after, easing into my 60th birthday is surprising and fabulous. And it's all part of what we talk about in the book, because the book is really capturing sort of a crazy series of events and life transitions that led me to found a global women's organization. And I had been in the world of advertising for 25 years, which is not a global women's organization. It's actually a pretty tough, competitive, still somewhat male-dominated world. And when I had a culmination of, I was running a company during the recession. It was very tough in the business world. I got news that cancer I had successfully battled once had come back, and I needed to have surgery. My last child was about ready to leave for college, and when I went to tell my boss, hey, I got to take a couple weeks off, have this surgery, but I've had cancer before, I'll be back, he said, I'm going to have someone else run the company. And I lost my job, my health, and my sort of self-definition all at once. And so this organization that I started called Parlay House, which empowers diverse groups of women around the world and gives them safe places to talk about things that we don't have other spaces to talk about, happened because I realized I was missing community, and in my case, female community, after an entire adulthood without having people to really support me on the deep level that I needed.
So the book, which is Parlay Effect, How Female Connection Can Change the World. It's a fascinating book. And tell us some of the stories that you've included in this book and about how it has changed the lives of so many women.
I will. It's interesting that these stories, which are about incredibly small actions that anybody in the world is capable of initiating, were a big aha for me. I had come from a world where power and privilege is what yielded results, and relationships were very transactional. And when I started gathering women at my home, I would hear stories of something that would happen that created a small cascade of good. For example, I started noticing it before Parlay House, where I was walking my dog in the park and I found a purse lying on the ground in the park. And it was obviously a young person's bag, something that one of my daughters might have dropped. And I thought, what a shame. It hadn't been there for long. It was kind of clean and in good shape. And I opened it up and I saw three sort of, not a driver's license, three pieces of ID that clearly said this is a young woman who's a student of some sort, and it had her address. There was about $40 in it, and I thought, oh, I would love if my daughters lost this for them to return it. So I popped it in the mail. I stuck an extra 20 in there as if to say to her, there are good people in the world, and I sent it off. Relatively soon, I got a handwritten note back saying, thank you so much for finding my purse. I was at a school field trip. This is a ninth grade girl. I was on a school field trip. I lost it. I was supposed to be responsible for paying for my dinner and paying for the entrance to the museum. And my friends had to rally around me to support me because this happened. And that gave me hope. And then you gave me hope. And then she went on to say, and I looked in the purse and I noticed that I had more money than I remembered having. I don't really understand how that happened, but when I went to school that day, there was a fundraiser for an organization that supports kids that don't have after school activities, and they were matching 3-to-1 whatever anybody donated. And so that extra money that I found, I donated. And I thought, oh my God, you know, one small action of returning a bag resulted not only in the encouragement of a young person, but in her multiplying the outcome to a wide number of other people. And I started seeing very similar cascades of good within my organization, where a woman would show up not knowing anyone. Someone would have an intimate conversation with her where she found she wasn't so alone. And at the next meeting, she would bring three other people who all found fulfillment and connection and sometimes jobs and sometimes friendships and sometimes introduction to new activities, all through small acts of being seen, being thought of, being included, being coached, being mentored. And when I started seeing this pattern, I thought, I've got to write about this and I've got to track this at a time when we feel so incredibly unempowered, and you know, we're living in a world where the divides between us all are greater and greater, our ability to change the course of political activities is tougher and tougher. This seems to be a way that there's a multiplier effect in our ability to create good. Wow, how fabulous. So I contracted with an amazing social scientist at UC Berkeley, Dr. Serena Chen, and together we designed a research study to track what was happening, because it seemed like it was a lot more than just pay it forward. So we did research where we did an online quantitative study where people could answer a questionnaire, and we would get a larger sense of what people's experiences were. And it was all about trying to track this cascade effect that was happening. So we grouped people who responded in three buckets. The first we called the givers. And the givers were people who could tell us a story of a time they did something thoughtful, kind, to somebody else that had a cascade effect in some way. The second bucket of people we called the receivers. Can you tell us a time where somebody did something for you that changed the way you behaved or felt or viewed the world in some meaningful way? Those were the receivers. And then we thought, uh-oh, we don't want our research to fail, so let's have a fail-safe third bucket that we're calling the witnesses. These are people who can't tell us any time they did anything meaningful for somebody else, can't tell us any time that somebody did anything particularly good for them, but they knew of something, they'd seen something. And the results were fascinating. First of all, the givers are the people that you already know, those thoughtful people who do initiate on behalf of other people. And they're the ones you can rely on to sort of notice that you might need an extra hug or see that you might want to be included in something or that you need coaching at work. The receivers, not totally shockingly, when they were the recipient of something, took on the behavior of the givers. So it was a message to them about how great they could make someone else feel in the same way that they'd felt. And I thought, okay, this is pay it forward. This is exactly what I thought was happening. And then we looked at the data from the witnesses. And the witnesses would tell us stories of, I saw something happen. I saw a guy walk out of 7-Eleven with an extra sandwich for the homeless person standing outside, and I saw that homeless person walk across the street and share the sandwich with others. And when I saw that happening, the next time I went to 7-Eleven, I remembered that and I did the same thing. And that to me was the big aha, because it was not one action that hit one other person who ate the sandwich. It was one action, a shared sandwich, and then the replication of that action by another person. And it gave me such incredible hope that we as individuals and we as new definitions of communities have power at a time when many of us feel especially unempowered. And that's what the book is about.
Well, it is very inspiring. And I just want to tell all of my listeners that first they should get the book, and then you have a website where they can go and find out more and sign up and just in general learn more about Parlay House. And that's the name of the website, Parlay House. And
we actually have three interwoven websites. So Parlay House is our global organization,
okay,
where we're in nine cities around the country. We meet in person in homes. The idea is inviting strangers into your home and seeing how amazing it is to get outside of your bubble and meet people who are ages, 20 to 90, and diversity across all definitions, and talk about shared experiences, because we always have a speaker or a topic or an experience that grounds everybody and gives us sort of the opening for the shy person like you were, Patsy, and like I was, having a common way to start a conversation because you just experienced something makes being social much easier and sort of opens up the door to being able to have these conversations. And so, that's what we do at Parlay House in nine cities around the world, and that's parlayhouse.com. But the Parlay Effect, which is the Parlay, P-A-R-L-A-Y, as in to parlay one thing into another, and as in the gambling term that the stakes are higher when we're in it together, is the book site. And then I have a personal website, AnnDevereauxMills.com, which you can get to through any of the others. But there you can sign up for a monthly newsletter that sort of provides some of these stories and insights about positive things that are happening in the world and ways that we can be part of it that I find helpful, and so do my many thousands of readers.
So how are you doing this with the nine cities? You have nine cities around the world at the moment. Are you expanding that?
We are. And one of the reasons I wrote this book is because as a one human, I can only do so many things in so many places. But, since we're everywhere from big cities around the United States and London and Paris to soon to be emerging in places like Amman, Jordan, I need other people who believe in the power of connection and in our ability to lift each other to start Parlay House movements in their cities and start having those inclusive conversations. And so this really not only provides insight about yourself as part of this process, but provides encouragement that you have the capacity to do that and to pull people forward.
So people who might be interested in doing this, they can contact you and...
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we have an amazing organization that can support that happening.
And these events are free of charge?
Nope. No? They're $25 because we provide lovely food and uh-huh. wine and, you know, it's actually a terrific bang for your buck, and we wanted it to be something that anybody could start without having to have the means to host on their own dime.
Uh-huh.
So it's a way for our hosts to either break even or make a little bit of money, and it's just a way to keep the organization sustaining without needing it to be a nonprofit.
Well, I think that's very reasonable. But the people who, do they have to have enormously big houses in order to be involved in this? Or
No. And in fact, this really is about the opposite of that. So you include whatever number of women can fit in a way where you feel people are comfortable and yet there's energy. So, there are places around the world where we might have 20 or 30 people at a time. There are places where we have 90 people at a time. And it's not about the numbers. It's about the actual experience.
And over the years, I mean, are you going to try to personally attend some of these events?
I am. I've been to every event in every city so far. And, you know, when we start having events in phenomenal and exotic places like Amman and like Paris and, even fantastic places in the U.S., I'm there as much as possible. In the next couple of months, we'll be launching in Atlanta and Denver and Seattle. And it's just terrific, the women that are stepping forward to do this. For example, the Denver chapter is headed by a woman who, when I had my first child, and she's now 28 years old, and I was a working mom, I had to go back to work after 4 weeks, and I hired an 18-year-old from Aberdeen, South Dakota, who showed up with a shaved head like Sinead O'Connor and tattoos on her chest at a time where tattoos weren't as much of a thing, and she took care of my newborn, first person to care for my newborn daughter. And she, who has become a paralegal and is working with lawyers in her office to be the hosts of Denver, stepped forward and said, I will make it happen a generation later. And that feels incredibly connected and fulfilling to me and exciting.
Now, when the women get together, so we have a very diverse group of people. You don't know
it
who's
is.
Going to sign up. And
right.
So the goal is to really network and
no, this is the great thing. It is
not
networking.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's what
I don't know if you.
I'm not great at networking. So that's
I hate it.
Good.
So the whole we have very, very few rules. But two of our key rules at Parlay House gatherings is non-extraction. If you're starting a nonprofit and need marketing support, it is not okay to come and ask someone who is having the one night during the month that she gets to do something that's about her and for her and lifting her up for a favor. It might happen that you meet people and you connect and you continue the relationship and you're able to support each other outside of Parlay House. But our number one rule is non-extraction. You know, listen, be vulnerable, tell your story, get to know people on a level other than what they do for a living. But this is really about building new definitions of community that are much broader than what we naturally fall into in the course of our lives.
Well,
and the other,
that's what I didn't want it to be like a mini Chamber of Commerce kind of meeting.
Exactly.
I want it to be real human meetings.
Exactly. There are plenty of those opportunities for people to support each other and build contacts and build their business. And I'm not anti that. I just didn't want that for what I was bringing to the world.
Well, I think that's the right attitude, because, and it's a matter of, it's funny how women from different backgrounds can become very close friends. You think, somebody who's maybe has an ordinary, everyday kind of job, maybe in an office, won't be a friend with a doctor. But yet, sometimes these connections can be very, very strong. And I know over the years that I've, met people that I've become really connected to people way out of my ordinary circle of people.
Yep. And the nice thing, because we don't talk about what we do for a living, that's why I framed this organization. When I didn't know who I was without being able to say what I did for a living, I realized that was a bad thing. So it happens quite often that members become friends with each other, having no idea that one is, works at the post office and one runs a company, until much, much later. And by that time, they're already such good friends that the differences in what they're doing doesn't matter, and it's the connections that matter. And you'll love one of our annual events based on this show and your personal interests. Once a year in August, and it happens because Mark Twain wrote about the coldest winter he ever knew was a summer in San Francisco, we have a book event. But it's not a book club where we analyze a book. It's a book event where you bring a book that tells a story of your life in some meaningful way and has moved you. And at the end of the evening, you take home the book of a woman you connected with and continue to read her story and talk about it in that context. And it's an amazingly unique and fun way to reframe yourself that supports writers and storytelling and allows you to tell a piece of yourself that wouldn't happen if you presented in a way that was a traditional definition of who you were as defined by work or family.
Oh, I love that idea. I think, well, of course, it has books involved, so I jump on that right away. But I do love the idea of for me, books are very important, and I so enjoy when I can find a book and that is meaningful to me and then give it to somebody. And I am fortunate that now I can often give books away. And then they come back to me and they say, wow, that was great for me. I learned something, and it just expanded my horizons.
Yes, exactly.
Now,
exactly.
What is a book that you've given to people? What do you have a book that you...
Right now, the books that I'm drawn to are... Strong female characters as the lead. So, over the years, it's been Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine, or Where the Crawdads Sing, or Educated, but I also this year love Ocean Vuong's amazing book On Earth We Are Briefly Gorgeous, because it was about vulnerability and truth, and that resonated with me. I gave The Tattooist of Auschwitz, because as someone who was born into a Jewish family, understanding the experience, not only the love story of two people, but the experience and the tests that were put to at different stages in our life also resonated with me. So, I tend to be the person who brings five books, because I have so many different pieces of my story that are fun to tell. But there's no wrong answer. This is about, how do you frame it and why?
Well, I love your choices. And Gail Honeyman has been on the program a number of times. And we've had so much fun talking about Eleanor. And I'm just a great fan of her. So that's an absolutely terrific, terrific choice. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today, because, as I said, I think your book is inspirational. I think that it will help people. And the important thing is that people, all the women out there, know that there are other women that you can meet, that you can get to know, and that can help you, and that you can help. And it's a wonderful gift that you've given the world with this book called The Parlay Effect, by Anne Devereaux Mills, and it's available wherever books are sold. And again, just repeat your websites that you want people to go to.
Great. Parlay, P-A-R-L-A-Y, house.com and theparlayeffect.com are probably the two best resources.
Okay. And they should go there and get the book and find out more, because maybe there will be a meeting in one of their towns coming up.
Yeah,
soon.
or they might want to create one.
They might want.
You know, there's no end to where this could take us.
Okay. Well, I think you've done a terrific job with this book. And again, I want to thank you, Anne, so much for being a guest on Joy on Paper today. It's been a real joy. And
thank you.
I'm so glad that you have, you know, you overcame so much, as I did too, and that we have found the joy of writing and just the joy of life.
Indeed. Thank you so much for having me, Patsy.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow. What a woman. Absolutely terrific. And what a clever idea, this parlay effect. Parties, so you can have a party in your house. If any of you out there in our area, Tampa Bay, St. Petersburg, Clearwater area, if you are interested, you might want to contact her and see if you can have a parlay effect party right in your own home and get to meet more people. I'm sure that she has a system of inviting people and getting people involved, and it would be a terrific thing to do. We're talking the beginning. My goodness, it's 2020, all of us. And one of the things that I've been telling everybody, of course, is that if you start writing now at the beginning of the year, by the end of the year, you'll have a book, and you won't be ready to. You won't be ready to get on Joy on Paper, because one of the things that everybody will tell you, every writer will tell you, that the book, writing the book is the first part. Editing is the big thing after that. But in a year and a half or so, you might have a book, and you can be here, right here on Joy on Paper, and share your joy of writing, because that's the whole point of everything that I'm talking about, and all of the authors that I'm going to have on this year will be talking about just finding that outlet that you need to tell your story, whether it's your family story, ghost story, cookbook, or whatever, because there is a story in all of us. So remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't unless you start writing. So start today, a page a day, and in a year you'll have a book. Meanwhile, say something nice to somebody, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. He's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. Bye-bye, everyone. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Bye.